and renewed his call for the federal government to give the state access to a Department of Homeland Security database. Greg Allen, NPR News, Miami.
The House and Senate reportedly have agreed on a way to keep student loan interest rates from doubling. They've attached a measure to a transportation bill they also agree on. House Transportation Committee Chairman John Mica says the longer-term transportation bill was crucial, too, rather than a short-term extension because of the construction jobs it will create in an uncertain economy.
The public just cannot wait, nor can jobs and the construction industry.
Lawmakers have until Saturday to take final action to keep the student loan rates from going up and to keep transportation projects going. And once again, the Supreme Court says President Obama's signature health care law is constitutional. It has survived 5-4. I'm Paul Brown, and this is NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Sony Pictures Home Entertainment with The Artist, a romantic comedic drama starring Jean Dujardin and Bérénice Bejo, now on Blu-ray and DVD.
Join us in September for WILL's Civil War Train. Board vintage train cars for stops in Vicksburg, Atlanta, Kennesaw Mountain, Chickamauga, and New Orleans. Visit the Smithsonian Southern and Southeast Railway Museums and see Civil War-era Washington, D.C. The trip is nearly sold out. Call 217-333-7300 or visit www.will.illinois.edu/willtravel for more information.
WILL programs are made possible by Bevere Cafe, open for breakfast and lunch this summer from Tuesday through Friday. Staffed and managed by students, Bevere Cafe is located in Bevere Hall at Goodwin and Gregory on campus. Daily menus are available online at bevercafe.illinois.edu.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk show. I'm David Inge. Glad to have you with us. So what is your idea of the ideal travel destination? Well, maybe it would be a pristine white sand beach, or maybe it would be a city, an old city that would have a cultural site almost everywhere you turn. The guest for this hour, writer Andrew Blackwell, decided that he would do something a little different, that he would travel to some of the places that, well, few people want to visit, places where the air, the soil, and the water can be toxic. And in the process of doing that, he took the idea of ecotourism in an entirely different direction. This morning in this hour of our program, he will take us on a tour of some of the world's most polluted places, and that is the subject of his new book. The title is Visit Sunny Chernobyl. It is published by the Rodale Press and out just recently. Andrew Blackwell is a journalist and filmmaker. He makes his home in New York City. He's a 2011 fellow in nonfiction literature from the New York Foundation for the Arts. And this book, Visit Sunny Chernobyl, is his first. He's joining us by telephone. And as we talk, questions from listeners are welcome. Well, they always are. Here in Champaign-Urbana, the number is 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, if you would like to use that. Calls on us, if it would be long-distance call for you, that's 800-222-9455. And we have email, so if you'd like to send along a question or comment that way, you may. And that is will-talk@illinois.edu. So at any point here, you have questions or comments, you can join us. And Andrew Blackwell, hello.
Hi.
Thanks very much for talking with us. We certainly appreciate it. You know, in one of the blurbs for the book, did indeed use the term ecotourism, and I was thinking about that myself beforehand when I thought, how does one explain exactly what this book is, that it takes ecotourism and kind of turns it on its head. And I wonder, do you think when you look at this book and what you've done, do you in fact think that this is a kind of ecotourism?
You know, I absolutely do think that it is. I really sort of, part of what got me obsessed with the whole topic in the first place and sort of visiting polluted places in person was that I sort of had a realization that maybe the idea of ecotourism, going somewhere interesting that also has something, you know, educational value and a real fascination with the environment, that idea was missing out a whole side of the coin. Although obviously there's some comic value or ironic value in, you know, wanting to take your vacation in the most polluted places in the world, I also really felt like no, wait a second, the ecotourists are missing out on something here. There's some other kinds of interesting environments that are worth exploring.
Yeah, and I think it certainly made me think about the fact that even people who consider themselves to be committed environmentalists, or maybe one would say, well, no matter how you feel about the environmental issues that confront us, most of the time these things are, while they ultimately affect everyone, they can be remote. And one wonders how it would affect one's commitment to dealing with these things if you could have some personal experience. You could be up close and personal with them rather than learning whatever you know about these things by reading about the subject or by listening to somebody talk about it.
You know, that's exactly right, and that was a real motivation for me. I originally had this idea when I was in India on a long vacation, and almost by accident, I ended up spending a few days in a city called Kanpur, which had just been named most polluted city in India by the government, which really takes some doing in a country like India that has lots of pollution. And I just, you know, aside from being incredibly polluted, smoggy, really bad stuff in the water and the river, I found it really fascinating place. I met a lot of interesting people, and I noticed that the environmental movement in a town like Kanpur, it has a lot more in common with what we in the U.S. might recognize as a civil rights movement, because it's not just that, you know, I care about the environment, I care about living green or reducing my footprint. It's that I smell and see and touch these issues every day when I walk out the door. And I thought, it made me realize I have, even though I care about the environment, I've got very little first-person experience of the issues that are kind of some of the biggest issues of our day. And I thought, all right, I'm going to go out and just try to rub my nose in the worst problems I can find.
And I think that what you have done that's useful is, in one of the things you've done that's useful is you're bringing people back into the story, because perhaps with the possible exception of Chernobyl, where nobody lives now, very few people. People do live in these places, and they have to contend on a daily basis with the facts on the ground.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And, you know, what's also interesting is that's the people who live there are going to know in the most intimate way possible what the issues are. A place like Port Arthur in Texas, it's a pretty poor city surrounded by refineries. Everyone in town knows that that's probably a health problem, certainly an aesthetic problem. And so it's really interesting to find out about issues like that and the history of how those refineries got there and whether or not they should be there and whether or not they're operating safely from people who live right next to them, maybe even people who benefit from them and work for them. You can really, you know, over a beer, get in touch with questions like that from all angles in really complex, fascinating ways. So, you know, if that's not vacation, I don't know what is.
Well, that's also, I think, points at another one of the complicating factors here. When you go to a place like Port Arthur, for example, or you go to the place where in Canada, where the oil sands are and where they're digging up oil, which eventually will end up in Port Arthur on the other end of that pipeline, or, right, you know, wherever it is that you go, that if industry is the source of pollution, well, it's also inextricably tied with the local economy and people's ability to live and make a living. So it's not the kind of thing that people can walk away from.
That's exactly right. And, you know, when we're talking in the abstract, if I'm debating or talking about environmental issues in the abstract, I feel it's a little bit sometimes of a seen as a cop-out, or it's not really my style to say, well, but industry, you know, also is so important. And I mean, of course it is, but sometimes I don't know if I really mean it, because of course I just would prefer that, you know, the world be lean and green and beautiful. And so when you're actually in, you know, a place like Fort McMurray in Alberta where they do the oil sands, you're meeting people who work there, you're seeing just the incredible monumental fact of these huge open pit mines, I sort of feel like it keeps you honest about the extent to which, you know, our system does have a huge footprint, and we are part of it, and we can't just walk away from it, which is a pretty sobering thing. But, you know, I guess I'd rather, you know, face it in person than just sort of wishing it away. Yeah.
Just real quick, our guest in this hour is Andrew Blackwell. He's journalist and filmmaker. His book is Visit Sunny Chernobyl and Other Adventures in the World's Most Polluted Places, published by Rodale. Questions again, welcome, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, I suppose if one was going to choose some extremely polluted places to go, it would be natural to go to the place where we had maybe the most famous industrial accident in history, and that would indeed be Chernobyl.
That's exactly right. And I sort of think of Chernobyl as the pollution tourist's gateway drug, if you will, you know, because it's a fascinating place, and especially if you go in the spring or the summer, it's an undeniably beautiful place. You know, it's a very large area that's been quarantined off because it's contaminated with radioactive material, and it's been quarantined off for more than a quarter century now. And so wilderness, you know, plants and animals have kind of flooded back in and taken over where there were many tens of thousands of people living and working. And so in a really strange way, it's both one of the most polluted places in the world, but it's also one of the largest wilderness preserves, accidentally, in mainland Europe. And, you know, questioning and sort of challenging my assumptions about what polluted looks like, or what natural looks like, or what counts as natural or ruined or artificial, was really important to me, because I think some of our ideas of what counts as nature can lead us to kind of give up on a place, on a lot of places that we think are already ruined. So Chernobyl, I defy anyone to take a day trip to the exclusion zone in the spring and tell me that it's not just a beautiful place, which doesn't mean it's not scary. It doesn't mean it's necessarily, it's not good that it happened, but it's definitely beautiful. So I think that's a really interesting and difficult connection. Yeah.
Well, I'm sure that on one level, on a rational level, you would know that to go to this place and to spend a day there, it's not going to kill you. You wouldn't
right.
want to live there, but you could go there for a day, then it would be okay. But yeah. The thing is, I think about one of the things about radiation, I think that frightens people is that you can't see it, and there is nothing really obvious. And I would guess that you would go there and you would be in this place, and on one level you'd look around and you'd see that it really is very beautiful. And at the same time, I would imagine that it, like, your skin would sort of crawl a little bit, because you would be sort of thinking, what's here that I can't see?
Right, that's exactly right. I mean, you're putting your finger exactly on the issue with radiation. It's, you know, even for people who are scientifically inclined, I think, radioactive contamination, it's very hard to understand. It's invisible, just in terms of the epidemiology of, you know, you want to say that no level is safe, but actually we are constantly being irradiated at some low level just by walking around. And so, you know, you're going around in Chernobyl, you see the birds tweeting and the bees flying by and the trees waving in the wind, and, you know, everything seems pretty chill. But, you know, then you hear your Geiger counter clicking and beeping, and it's impossible not to feel a little freaked out. But I sort of feel like that's part of the educational experience, you know. You never get so interested in exactly how gamma rays work when you're worried that you might be getting too many.
Yeah. Well, when you're there and you're standing and you're looking at the remains of the plant there, the place where this happened,
the reactor,
it's, you know, you can, yeah, there's a picture of it, I guess, here on the cover. And I suppose you look at it and it just maybe looks like an industrial building. It's made out of sort of gray concrete and looks like what you would expect. Does looking at it standing there make any particular kind of impression on you?
You know, that's interesting, because I didn't think it would. I thought you know, it wouldn't be that different from seeing the Eiffel Tower, frankly. So, you know, there might be that flash of recognition because I remember when I was a kid when Chernobyl happened and we saw that first picture of the reactor building and half of it was just destroyed. And then I'd seen pictures of the sarcophagus that they built over it and this sort of iconic cooling tower that sticks out of the middle. And so I knew I'd recognize it, but I thought, well, that's going to be about it. But it actually ended up being a kind of frightening experience, maybe just by chance. It had been a really beautiful day going around the zone and seeing the deserted city that was nearby and, you know, hanging out by the river and so on. And then we got over towards the reactor, and a thunderstorm, for one thing, came up very dramatically right at that moment. And then just like the immediate surroundings of the reactor are still kind of an industrial zone. It's still a lot of concrete. You know, there are cranes there. Now they've started building a new shelter for it. And it just was quite forbidding. And the building was also a lot larger than I realized it would be. And that sort of made me realize, sort of get in touch with the just awesome power that is inherent to something like a nuclear reactor. And thinking about that power just sort of like running loose, running rampant across this landscape and how like scary and destructive and, you know, terrifying that must have been. And then, of course, your Geiger counter is bleeping a little more earnestly because you're near the reactor. So it ended up being kind of a terrifying experience, actually, which I really didn't expect.
As you said, one of the things that you can do or that people do when they go there is they go and visit this town, Pripyat, which was the place where the people who worked at the plant lived.
Yeah.
And you can, and actually, if people are curious, people can go online, Google that, Pripyat, Pripyat, and you can see pictures of it. And it's really spooky. And it looks like just like what you would think if one day somebody walked in and said, all right, now everybody leave now. Grab something if you want, but now we're going. And in what, at one time on one day, everybody just picked up and left. And whatever they couldn't carry, they left. And it's still sitting there.
That's exactly right. Yeah, it's a fascinating and extremely spooky place. It's been pretty thoroughly looted. So anything of value got carried off by looters who clearly didn't care that they were getting a little extra.
The stuff was radioactive, yeah.
Dose. But that's exactly right. You know, I walked into a kindergarten, and there are still toys lying on the floor covered in dust. There's still little school chairs, you know, lying around on their sides. And, you know, and that's also just really sobering. I think, you know, always people have a fascination with antiquity and ruins, and really sort of makes you confront how ephemeral not just each of us is, but our actual civilization. And here you have a ruin that's, you know, only 20, 25 years old. Most of the people who live there probably are still healthy, but it's still very sobering. And then to see sort of how quickly wildlife and plant life are overtaking that also sort of makes you realize that kind of however much we ruin the world or transform it or maybe, you know, ruin our own chances for a sustainable, healthy civilization for people, that life will definitely go on once we're gone.
I think that it's the case that you, when you went there, it hadn't really been open to tourism yet, but now it is a if you decide you want to go there, it is possible you can go there and you can go on a tour. And how do you have any idea how many people are actually queuing up to do that?
I asked, I'm not totally sure. I asked someone who had been to Kiev more recently than me, and she, I think it's on the order of in the hundreds per year. So, or maybe it's a couple thousand, something like that. So I'm guessing they probably get a dozen, two dozen people a day, something like that. When I went, you know, it wasn't officially open to tours, but it was openly known that if you really wanted to visit, you could. I think just it was a little, the paperwork was a little more difficult to fill out. But and it's, you know, even I can't recommend it enough, frankly. You know, if you, Kiev is a lovely town, and you can go to Chernobyl for a day trip, and it's an absolutely fascinating place.
Our guest is Andrew Blackwell. He's a journalist and filmmaker. His first book includes the story of this trip that he made to Chernobyl and also some other places. In fact, some of the world's most polluted places. That is the subtitle. His book is Visit Sunny Chernobyl, and it's published by the Rodale Press. And questions and comments are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, one certainly shouldn't, we shouldn't give people the idea that the kind of places we're talking about are exclusive to the developing world, because here on our side of the Atlantic and in Canada, where you grew up, and here in the United States, we certainly have polluted places. What was it that made you want to go to the to Alberta and to check out the place where, interestingly enough, now I guess most of the oil that we use comes from?
Well, I think you know, Canada in general. It's not that most of our oil in the U.S. specifically comes from Alberta and oil sand. But Canada is definitely our number
one. Well, that's just that. And I think a lot of people would really be surprised by that. They'd think, oh, well, isn't that in terms of our foreign suppliers of oil? I'm sure most people would think, well, it has to be Saudi Arabia, or it has to be somebody in someplace in the Middle East. And it, in fact, is Canada.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I'm sure if you add up the Middle Eastern countries, they beat Canada. But, yeah, Canada is a huge, towering, earth-shaking petroleum superpower, basically. And one of the innovative things, which is not to say that it's positive, that they've done is started to exploit in a huge way these oil sands, which are concentrated in northern Alberta, which are basically buried, sticky, tar sand. And the reason that it's controversial, beyond just being a fossil fuel, is that it takes an incredible amount of energy to get the stuff out of the ground, and then you've got to boil it in gigantic vats of water to separate the petroleum from the sand, and then you've got to sort of upgrade or pre-refine the tar that you separated out before you can even do the things you would do with normal crude oil. And I just thought, you know, everything there is the biggest thing in the world. They've got the biggest trucks carrying the sand around, being loaded by the biggest shovels in the world inside the biggest open pit in the world. And they use the most energy of any industrial project. And it just, I felt, you know, this is a place just full of monuments. One of the companies, there's a lot of sulfur that, as a byproduct of this upgrading process, and one of the companies has nowhere to sell or get rid of the sulfur, so they pour it into slabs and stack it in pyramids. So they're actual gigantic yellow pyramids in Fort McMurray, as big as the pyramids of Giza, although they're kind of flat-topped, so they're kind of these gigantic Mayan, Canadian yellow pyramids. And I thought, you know, these are, you know, even if there's something terrifying about this whole project, these are also the monuments of our age. This is what the human project on the earth is. And I want to go to one of its, like, biggest, scariest temples and see it in person.
Yeah. And I think that this is, I'm sure that it's also enlightening in a sense, because I'm sure that most of us, when you think about where oil comes from, you think, okay, so you drill a hole in the ground and it and it shoots out, right? That's
right.
As a liquid product, you know.
Ideally, yeah.
But this is a completely different method of production, where you have to take this stuff and you have to distill it in a sense and get it out of there, and in the process, produce an enormous amount, use a lot of energy, but also produce an enormous amount of waste, in addition to a great big hole in the ground.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, all kinds of waste. The water that is being used as part of the upgrading process gets stored in huge lakes called tailings ponds, and you know, those lakes are if you're a duck and you land in the wrong tailings pond, you're a goner. And there have been huge lawsuits and prosecutions in Canada over the question of whether or not oil sands companies have sufficiently deterred migrating birds from landing in their tailings ponds. So, you know, there's all sorts of ways in which those projects interact with the environment that are really fraught. And, you know, but there's all kinds of stuff happening in this kind of second wave of oil exploration. Down in Port Arthur, you know, I got to see one of the first places where, or actually the first place where oil really shot out of the ground in that classic gusher style. But, you know, up in Alberta, it's much more complicated, you know, and there are other places with fracking and so on where oil exploration is getting, you know, to further and further levels of complication because it's still worth it to get that oil out of the ground.
Yeah. So there in Alberta, you can the company actually does that does this work runs tours, so they will show you something of the operation. But I gather that really to get the sense of the impact, what you have to do, one has to do is you really have to fly over it so you can see it from the air. That's really the only way to take in the enormity of this hole that they have made.
Yeah, you know, when I got up there, I mean, you know, I have a certain just gusto for seeing, you know, as a reporter, for just like seeing things for myself. And so when I got up there, I heard that there was an oil sands bus tour, and I thought, this is great. They're doing my work for me. And, you know, nothing's going to be weirder than, you know, an air-conditioned bus tour of this absolutely terrifying open-pit landscape. And it was so disappointing because we got to see the upgrading plant and a couple parked trucks, but otherwise we didn't see anything. They did not let us see into the mine. They did not let us drive across or along the edge of the mine, much less let us go hiking, which is, of course, I really wanted to go for a hike. And I found it so upsetting because I felt like, look, I'm not doing an expose here. Everyone knows that oil sands are really problematic. So I'm not trying to, like, catch you guys in anything. And this entire town is just devoted to oil sands. Everything happens there. The entire economy runs off of the oil sand industry, and yet they won't really let you see it if you're a visitor and in person. And I felt like that's incredibly representative of the kind of violent ambivalence that certainly in Canada people have about oil sands, and maybe that all of us have about industry and fossil fuels. It's, you know, we depend on it utterly, but we kind of don't really want to see it, even when it happens to be this absolutely unignorable fact, like a giant artificial Grand Canyon in northern Alberta is unignorable. So, yeah, eventually I just gave up, and I hired a little plane and had a guy fly me over. And, indeed, it's an astonishing sight. It is similar to seeing the Grand Canyon, I felt.
We're talking this morning in this hour focus with Andrew Blackwell. We're talking about what you will find in his new book, Visit Sunny Chernobyl and Other Adventures in the World's Most Polluted Places. We'll talk some more after a very short break. This is Focus.
Support comes from Meyer Drapery Services. Specializing in custom draperies since 1972, Meyer Drapery offers more than 1 million linear yards of drapery material in their two local wholesale warehouses and retail outlet at 330 North Neal in downtown Champaign. Installation and design services are also available.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. I'm David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In the second hour of the program today, we'll be talking about politics, presidential politics particularly. Our guest will be Samuel Popkin. He is a professor of political science at the University of California, San Diego, has been a campaign advisor and certainly follows politics. And we will be talking about his book, The Candidate, What It Takes to Win and Hold the White House. Then tomorrow in the 10 o'clock hour, our guest is Brian Adams. He is assistant director of the Illinois State Archaeological Survey, based on the campus of the University of Illinois. And we'll be talking about a book that he has written that celebrates the work of an architect who designed a number of buildings in Urbana, and they're buildings that probably all of us, if we live here, we've walked by them many times and probably haven't thought very much about who designed them. But I'm talking about here, like the Champaign County Courthouse, the entrance to the Urbana High School, the Urbana Free Library. His name was Joseph Royer. He was a graduate of the University of Illinois and was active in our community for about 50 years. So we'll talk about him and his work with Brian Adams tomorrow morning at 10. You can look at the schedule and listen to past programs by going to our website. That's will.illinois.edu. You can also follow us on Twitter at Will Public Media. In this hour, the guest is Andrew Blackwell. He's journalist and filmmaker. He makes his home in New York City. He is the author of the book Visit Sunny Chernobyl and Other Adventures in the World's Most Polluted Places, and the book's published by the Rodale Press. We have some callers to talk with. Let's do that. We'll go to Belgium, line number 4 for a caller. Hello.
Hello, and good morning to you all. I have a couple, 3 places to mention also, but the one that comes to mind immediately is in western Maryland and West Virginia, where they just literally take the tops off of mountains to get the coal. And then they push the top of the mountain down into the ravine. And it causes enormous problems environmentally just to get some more coal. It's high-quality anthracite, but it's still nothing but dirty coal and destroying a very pretty place in America. The other 2 I'd like to mention really aren't available to the public, but they're very dangerous places. One would be Hannaford in eastern Oregon, and the other one right next to Denver is Rocky Flats Arsenal, where they've had enormous amounts of plutonium strewn all over these areas, and they're slowly migrating in water tables and dust and whatever else to people who happen to be living nearby.
Hmm. Yeah, I imagine, Andrew, you would have been interested in maybe in visiting a site, or would you have been interested in visiting a site belonging to the Department of Defense?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, Hanford, I think Hanford actually is in eastern Washington.
Oh, okay.
And that's definitely a fascinating place, and who knows what they have, buried and spilled over the years out there. I do think that I'm not sure of the exact status of this, but there's actually a national park being created dedicated to the Manhattan Project, which is, I believe, going to be located sort of in a series of sites around the country that were involved in research and production of the first atomic bombs. And that's kind of, something that I also find fascinating, that, national park, we initially think, well, that means Yellowstone, that means Yosemite, and to have something associated with nuclear production and, atomic warfare is not the first thing you think of. But I actually think something like that is really good because it challenges your idea of, is a park just there to look pretty? Is a park there also to be thought-provoking or to memorialize things that might be good or bad but are definitely part of our history and our heritage?
If I might mention one other area that is very close to us here in East Central Illinois, is there's a place down near Newport, Indiana, where there was a huge amount of nerve agents. And now they went in and cleaned up all the nerve agents and stuff like that, but surrounding this spot was a very large forest, hardwood forest, beautiful hardwood forest, several thousand square acres. And they are now talking in turning that into a park, which I thought was a very nice idea.
Yeah.
Because you don't see large tracts of undisturbed eastern woodlands like that.
That's exactly right. And that's one of the things that I find really fascinating about polluted places. And you can find these locally, is that because they're polluted, they have really bad reputations. Often people think they're something really disgusting or dangerous, not without reason either. But that means that people stay away, and in a way they can end up being sort of preserved or protected in other ways or underused in ways that make them sort of counterintuitively valuable. I live in Brooklyn in New York, and there's a industrial canal goes into Brooklyn called the Gowanus Canal. It's a Superfund site. It is supposed to be one of the most polluted waterways in the U.S. And for a long time, the Gowanus Canal, actually still, was just a punchline to jokes that you would tell in New York City. You know, if you live too close to the Gowanus, people would definitely make a face. And, you know, about 10 or 12 years ago, some guys decided that they were going to take a canoe out on the Gowanus Canal, which was just an absurd idea. But what grew out of that is what's now called the Gowanus Dredgers. It's a canoeing club. They've got a little clubhouse on the Gowanus, and you can go canoeing on the Gowanus. And they've sort of become a force for, you know, rehabilitating and reclaiming and reusing the Gowanus in a healthy way. And I've been canoeing on the Gowanus, and it smells a little funny, I'll admit, and I'm not sure what everything floating in there is, but it's actually nevertheless a really placid, quiet, great place to go canoeing, and I don't know where else you're going to find that in Brooklyn, certainly not that centrally. And, you know, so in a really paradoxical way, you know, these sort of forsaken, ruined places can sort of be havens even.
Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Let's go on to another caller here. This is someone in Eureka, line number one. Hello.
Hi, very interesting program. I'd like to go back to the tar sands, and I have heard, read, or saw somewhere that it was estimated that the tar sands have an amount of oil equal to Saudi Arabia or some figure like that.
It's definitely something huge.
Is that accurate?
There's a huge amount of tar sands in Alberta. They're not all accessible by digging. The digging can happen for some of the shallower deposits. A lot of the other material is deeper into the ground, so they've invented all sorts of ways to get that stuff out that involve injecting steam and all kinds of things into the ground to sort of liquefy it and bring it up. There is a huge amount of tar sands there for the future, for better or for worse.
The other problem you mentioned a little bit, but I hear it is just huge, is the pollution of the water. And I guess you mentioned it, that it takes more units of energy to extract the oil from the tar sands than it does from what you get from the end product.
No, not more than the end product, you know, because then there would definitely be no economic value to it. You know, it's more like, I don't remember exactly what the number is, but I think for every maybe four or five barrels of oil you get from oil sand, you have to spend a barrel worth of energy to get that oil.
Oh, okay.
So it's just not as efficient. And Fort McMurray, even though I think it's a town of maybe 100,000 people, has an incredible amount of, in terms of its carbon dioxide emissions, it's something outrageous on the order of Los Angeles or twice Los Angeles, because they use so much natural gas and all kinds of energy to make that process work.
To get back to the water, though, I guess it is really screwing up, or will screw up, the water system there for many, many years to come. Is that true, because of the amount of water it takes?
It's definitely a concern. You know, one thing that was fascinating to me about visiting these places is that the science around exactly what they mean is a lot murkier than you'd expect. And I tried to spend most of my time sort of in the experiential, meeting people, seeing things, smelling things mode, instead of trying to figure, you know, out things that people who devote their careers to it haven't figured out yet. But so there's definitely, like, big concerns about what's getting into the water in northern Alberta, just as there's big concerns about what does it mean to have a radioactive place like Chernobyl. What does that really mean for the health of people who were there when it happened, the health of people in that region? It's all a lot murkier than I expected, which is not to minimize those problems, but I thought it's fascinating that sort of things that I assumed were just known science are really sort of probably true, but it's just not black and white.
And I think maybe I get from what you're saying before, and that really nobody knows exactly what's going to happen as a result of it because of the unknowns.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's very hard to know. You know, there are some things that, you know, we do know but are less spectacular. You know, in the case, just to go back to Chernobyl for a moment, people spend, there's a lot of heat and energy and debate about, okay, what exactly are the health effects 25 years on? You know, how many extra cancers or birth defects have there been? Some people say it's a lot. Some people say it's very little. And everyone accuses everyone else of having an agenda. And I sort of feel that, well, putting that aside for a moment, if we can, the real cost is that hundreds of thousands of people were displaced from their homes and sort of became internal refugees in their own country. And I think that has had a real social cost and a real emotional and psychological cost. But it's sort of not as exciting as the idea of radiation and cancer. So sometimes I think when we get very focused on certain kinds of costs, we can lose track of other less spectacular costs.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. Other questions are welcome. We have about 12 or 13 minutes left in this part of the show with Andrew Blackwell, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, when you talk to people, say, in a place like Alberta, where they're producing the oil, the raw product, or you go to the other end of the line, you go to Port Arthur, Texas, where you went, which is a big refinery town, where in both cases, people's livelihood, the local economy, depends on that industry. So that's what makes it possible for people to make a living. How do they, though, think about the environmental downside of what it is that they do?
You know, in Alberta, I think people, it's sort of a straightforward ambivalence about it because people are literally being paid to do the work, and they see the effects. And, you know, some people are more pro-industry, some people are more ambivalent about it. A guy I talked to, he thought that it could be done responsibly, but that the companies weren't dishing out enough money to mitigate the environmental costs. In Port Arthur, you know, a big part of the question is that a lot of the people living with the worst effects of refineries, living really on the fence line, they're not really benefiting from these multi-billion dollar corporations that are stinking up their air. And so it's sort of interesting to talk to, I talked to one environmental activist there, very respected activist called Hilton Kelly, who's sort of also a local entrepreneur. And he both has fought the refineries and tried to get them to clean up their act, and even sort of wished at one point to me that they would just disappear completely. But he has also fought them to hire locally, because he doesn't think that they share the benefits, the economic benefits of those corporations with the local people. And so that's a really fascinating kind of duality right there.
Well, some of the places that you talk about, these are places where people live. They're living alongside them. They're living in the middle of them. Maybe their livelihood depends on them. I am interested. I want to make sure we talk a little bit about one place that's significant, and yet it's a place where nobody lives. It's a thing that people have heard about, and you went out to see, and that's the Great Pacific Garbage Patch.
Yeah.
And if people have heard about this, I think you would almost get the idea that there is this huge floating mass of stuff, of junk, and that you could actually sail up to it and step onto it.
Right.
And that's
Don't say the word island, David, or I'm going to have to hang up.
Okay. My apologies. Yeah, I won't say that. Yes. But that people would get the idea that there's this big, solid mass thing, and that so you went out to see the thing, and actually it's apparently not like that at all.
It's not like that at all. And again, this really gets to the question of why we always need a very concrete, shocking image in order to care about an environmental issue. There's this idea out there that the garbage patch is either a plastic island or that it's a solid mat of trash, like a real carpet. Hmm. And they always reference Texas for the size. It's always the size of Texas or sometimes twice the size of Texas, which I think people say just because it has a nice ring to it. And you get out there, it's not like that at all. And it's surprising to me the extent to which that island imagery persists. But you get out there, and it's actually quite hard to see. The biggest part of the problem is probably all these tiny plastic particles, which are plastic objects that have broken down into tiny pieces over the years. And then also, yeah, you just see very frequently a bottle float by, a crate float by, a hard hat, a laundry hamper. And so the mass of plastic out there and its most likely its effect on the ecosystem out there is definitely huge, definitely really problematic, definitely worth getting interested in or being concerned about. And but it does not correspond at all to this fantastical idea of plastic continent swirling around out there. And no one would have loved more than me to step onto the plastic island and camp out, because that would have been amazing. But
well, and there's no denying that this is a serious problem.
No, of course
but
not. Of
but
course
it
not.
I think the reality of it makes it less amenable to a solution. Now, maybe if you had a plastic island the size of Texas, that would still be a formidable problem. But yes, you could think about, well, okay, maybe you could do that. But if what you're talking about is vast tracts of land that have foam packing peanuts floating on them, the idea that you could go and somehow scoop everything up seems just not possible.
Yeah, I'm very skeptical about the idea that there's any way, efficient or even practical, possible way to clean it up, per se. And that's why I think most groups that are involved in the Great Pacific Garbage Patch really focus on raising awareness about it as a tool to change how much plastic we consume and throw away every day here on land, since obviously that's where it all comes from.
We have about 5 minutes left here. Again, I'll very quickly introduce the guest. We're talking with Andrew Blackwell. He is journalist and filmmaker and is author of the recent book Visit Sunny Chernobyl and Other Adventures in the World's Most Polluted Places. And indeed, it is about a number of visits that he made to some of the world's most polluted places, Chernobyl being one of them. And it's quite an interesting book. Might want to take a look at it. And someone wants to call real quick. We can get in a phone call, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Well, maybe I'll ask you to talk here, and then we have 3-4 minutes left, about what is said to be the most polluted city on Earth. It's in China, and you went and visited there. It's a place called Linfan.
Right, right. It's a fascinating place. It's sort of legendary as having the worst air in the world. And indeed, it is smoggy as hell there. I definitely would stay up late at night coughing from it. I talk about this book sort of as a love letter to polluted places, which is not to say that I think pollution is good. Although I think there's a lot less difference between what we think of as natural and polluted than we would like to admit. But I just feel sympathy for a place like Linfan, which if you look up Linfan, you'll see pictures of smog. You'll see a guy riding on a bike with a surgical mask on, and you'll see a picture of a coal miner looking really sad with his face all smudged with coal. And everything about it will be about how Linfan is the most polluted city in the world. And I just feel a little bit of sympathy for a place that around the world exists in people's minds only as a horror story. And I feel like that kind of, there's a disgust that gets attached to a polluted place like that. We're using it as a tool to sort of make ourselves care about these issues, which that's fine. But I kind of object to the disgust that goes with that, because I think that's actually a force for disengagement from issues and from polluted places, from places that, need, some tender loving care, as it were. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to go there and, really realize that this is also someone's home. You know, people live here. There are some good restaurants here. People grow up here. And that's really what I found in Linfen, in addition to, you know, experiencing what it's like to live in an incredibly, you know, polluted place in terms of air quality. I really did find a lot of things to like about Linfen, and I feel like, you know, I wanted to rescue it from just being a poster child for disgust. And so, you know, I was there right after the Spring Festival. There's a lot of civic life. There's people dancing in the town square. People were really friendly to me. And I thought, you know, this is what I was looking for. You know, not just to confirm that this place is a hellhole, but to also confirm that even a hellhole, if you can call it that, is worth visiting, worth caring about, you know, worth writing home about.
Yeah, well, I suppose that, as you say, the danger that if you identify some place as extremely polluted, then you're going to say that it's irredeemable, and then maybe what you do is you create an exclusion zone, and you could and you wall it off, and then either people have to leave, or you know they do whatever they can to survive, and then so that says, well, this place is hopeless. We can't really do anything about it, so we might as well forget it.
And, you know, the reality is the uncomfortable reality that I really think environmentally minded people have to face is that no corner of the world has gone untouched by our presence. And that's only going to increase, whether it's through extinction, climate change. Really, sort of everywhere on Earth is now no longer natural. Or you could say that it's still natural, but it's not conforming to our ideas of purity and perfection. And so, you know, it's time to claim a place that we think of as ruined and say, well, no, it's not ruined. It's different. It might be disappointing. It might be even unhealthy, but we can work with that. We can try to see what we can do to make this place still worth caring about. Because that's just a fact of life these days, that no place will, you know, really, if you look closely, satisfy our need for a sort of perfect, Edenic, pre-human nature in a bubble. It just doesn't really exist. And if it does, it's because we put a bubble around it. You know, a park like Yosemite is every bit as controlled and managed as the exclusion zone in Chernobyl, even more. But we think of it as in a different way because it's nature. And I don't know if that really is the way to motivate ourselves to care about the world and whether or not we're going to be able to live in it in a healthy way.
Yeah, we're almost done here, but and for you, it sounds as if you suffered no permanent ill effects from having gone to all these places.
Well, like I said, it's hard to tell. Not that I know of. but, you know, check back with me in 50 years, and even then I won't be able to know for sure if all my problems are because I spent a day and a night in Chernobyl.
Yeah, well, we certainly wish you well and continued good health. Our guest, Andrew Blackwell, he's a journalist and filmmaker. He makes his home in New York City and has some interesting things to say here in the book that we've been talking about, and you might want to take a look at it. Again, the title of his book is Visit Sunny Chernobyl and Other Adventures in the World's Most Polluted Places. It's published by the Rodale Press. And Mr. Blackwell, thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you so much, David.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Burlingame Home Inspection and Performance. Burlingame performs property inspections along with energy audits and ratings for Energy Star, tax credits, and efficiency mortgages, all utilizing infrared technology. More information is at cusaveenergy.com or 217-649-1173.
We'll take our usual break here, and when we continue with Focus, we'll be talking about American politics in the second hour with Samuel Popkin. He's professor of political science at UC San Diego. We'll talk about his recent book, The Candidate, What It Takes to Win and Hold the White House. First, though, we'll take a break for news and a market update. Stay tuned.
Agricultural programs are made possible by Risk Management Commodities Incorporated in Lafayette, Indiana, Chalmers, Indiana, and Hudsonville, Illinois. Risk Management Commodities focuses on managing risk in today's complex and sophisticated commodities market. 866-837-9027.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets, where at mid-session, Rabobank has issued a report to its clients that says that unless U.S. Midwest weather improves in coming weeks, Chicago Board of Trade December corn could hit $7.50 and even potentially challenge $8. Cuts in national yield projections. Well, Rabobank has got it down now to 154 bushels to the acre. That's down 12 bushels from what USDA has most recently put the corn at. Still, Rabobank says while it appears to be the driest June since 1988, don't go and compare this year's futures market to that 88 market just yet, because